Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the church today.
We'd like to welcome to Lutheran Radio Dr. Robert Dickey. He is the author of a chapter in a very interesting book entitled Scotland's Debt to Martin Luther. It's published by the Scottish Reformation Society. And we've invited him to discuss with us Alexander Alane, better known as Alexander Alasius. Dr. Dickey, welcome to Lutheran Radio. As I mentioned, this is an amazing book. I stumbled across it in a bookstore in Glasgow, and it immediately caught my attention. And I was particularly fascinated by your chapter. I'd heard about Alasius, but I did not know very much about him. Can you tell us a little bit why he's called Alexander Alane or Alexander Alasius?
Yes, it was one of these factors that that complicates history back at that time. People had a given name, obviously their first name and their surname, but for academic circles they often used a sort of nickname, and that was very common. I mean, for example, the name Luther, or Luther obviously in German, was partly based on his family name of Luder, but was a hint at the Greek word Eleutheria. And same with Melanchthon, whose name in German was Schwarzerd, which means black earth. And so he took the Greek name Melanchthon, which means black earth. It was the same with Alasius. He was given that name by Melanchthon when he was in Germany. And it's derived in a roundabout way from a Greek word which means wanderer. Now, when we come to look at the life history of Alexander Alane, Alexander Alasius, we find that he was indeed a wanderer by force of circumstances. He started in Scotland. He had no intention really of leaving Scotland, but the force of history compelled him to leave Scotland. And he had a rather roundabout trip to get to Germany. And so the name kind of stuck. Once Melanchthon gave him the name Alasius, he willingly embraced it. He signed himself off as Alasius, and to all intents and purposes, he gave up his own given surname.
And in your chapter, you provide a very interesting chronological account of his life. I think maybe if we start there, I think that's a great place to begin. Can you tell us, or what do we know about his childhood? We know he was born in Edinburgh in about 1500, but are there any things we know about his early years?
We know a number of things. I suppose the first is that he referred to his own background as being the son of an official. So it would seem that he was born to at least a middle-class background. There's no information about his father in any of the existing records, but there is information about his mother, who was related to a church dignitary. We know that he was brought up in Edinburgh, and a couple of incidents from his childhood days, which he mentions himself. And I'll just refer to those because they are quite interesting. They cast a little bit of light on what we know about him and what we know about young people in those days. Now, the first of these is that he fell from a cliff. And we don't know which cliff in Edinburgh. There's a few potential cliffs in Edinburgh that could be identified as places where he might have fallen. But the interesting thing is that he had a little, like a charm bracelet around about his neck. And this was a common thing for young people. The parents gave him a little capsule made of metal. It's attached to the chain around the neck. And inside the capsule was a piece of paper or parchment, which contained a verse of scripture. And this was given to them as a sort of charm to protect them. And Alasius refers to that incident and says that he wasn't protected by having a charm around his neck, but by the prayers of his parents. The other incident also refers to a fall. His father was building a house, and the young Eliseus was out on the balcony and fell off onto a pile of stones which were being prepared for the building. And once again, his life was preserved, and he said that was to do with the prayers of his parents.
So he obviously placed a high emphasis on prayer, particularly as he lived his life, and amazing stories. And I mean, you also tell us that at a very young age, he then goes off to St. Andrews to study. Was that a common thing?
He went to university at a relatively early age, around about the age of 12. And when he was enrolled at university in St. Andrews, he appears on their lists as a pauper, a poor person. It doesn't quite have the same sort of tone that the word pauper has nowadays, but it meant that he wasn't particularly moneyed, which is quite interesting because obviously his father had been wealthy enough to build a house. It would seem that his father had probably died by the time that he went to university, and in a couple of years' time his mother died, and we do know that because the property that she had, or a share of a property, was then gifted to the young Alexander. So these are the sort of facts we know about him as a very young person.
And he's very bright. I mean, he gets his bachelor's degree and then a master's degree, and he's also then becomes involved in the church. Was that his aim, or did that just happen to become a priest?
I think that so much of life in those days was around the existence of the church. For example, if you were a lawyer, it was based on church laws. And the intention was that he should become in some way associated with the church. And the university degree was a way of, shall we say, entrance to that type of work. So when we're talking about him getting a Bachelor of Arts and then a Master of Arts, it was with a view to a career at some level within the church.
And you refer to him as a keen scholastic theologian. What is a keen scholastic theologian in the Middle Ages?
Well, he was trained up in theology, and he became very adept at it. Because of the time that he was at university and his subsequent career, he was really at the time when the Reformation was beginning to take place, and it, of course it was taking place in far-off Wittenberg, but it had an immediate effect throughout Europe, and that included in St. Andrews. Now, St. Andrews, of course, was not only the largest town in Scotland in those days, it was probably bigger than even the capital, Edinburgh, but it had a massive cathedral, which was a site of pilgrimage. Now, the cathedral itself is almost 400 feet long. We only have the ruins of it nowadays, but you can tell the size of it. So it was a massive, massive building. And the whole of St. Andrews, which was where he went to university, was geared around the existence of the university, the existence of the cathedral, and St. Andrews as a place of pilgrimage for people from all over Europe.
And you mention that he was just finishing his career as a student right at the time Luther posted his 95 theses, and you noted that it doesn't take long for Luther's theology to reach the shores in Scotland and England. How did Eliseus view Luther's theology?
Well, of course, there were those who were were very much in favor of the Reformation, and there were those who stoutly opposed it. And Alesius had made such a name for himself as a person who could dispute, who could argue these points out with any people of the Reformed persuasion. And indeed, that was what he did. Of course, we have to remember that these people like Alesius were theoretical theologians. They didn't actually have a reformer to argue with. So they had the opinions of reformers, which they could read for themselves. And so they constructed their arguments on the basis of what they could read. But they didn't have the to and fro of disputing with, as you might say, a real reformer. And that, of course, changed when he was sent to try to convert one of the Scottish reformers who had been captured and was imprisoned in St. Andrews, and that was Patrick Hamilton. And Alain, or Alesius, as he was later known, was sent to argue and dispute with Patrick Hamilton in an attempt to recover him, to make him turn back from his views on Reformation to the fold of the Roman Catholic Church. And it was felt that Alain, or Alesius, had the gifts that would enable him to do that, that he had the powers of persuasion, that he had all the facts at his fingertips, and therefore he was the man to send to Patrick Hamilton.
And what happens when he does meet Patrick Hamilton and they have their discussions?
Yes, that's right. Well, over a period of 4 weeks, 4 weeks preceding the martyrdom of Patrick Hamilton, Alexander was disputing with him, and instead of turning Patrick Hamilton from his views, Patrick Hamilton's exposition of the Reformed faith began to work on the young Alexander Alain, to the point that certainly he did not have any opposition to the Reformed doctrines. He may have been, as you might say, a covert Reformed person himself. We know that at a later stage he gave very clear testimony of that when he signed up to the Augsburg Confession, but that was obviously much later. But he watched the martyrdom of Patrick Hamilton, which was a long drawn-out process. It was a burning at the stake, which lasted about 6 hours before Patrick Hamilton succumbed. And he was greatly moved by the cruelty of the execution, as indeed many other people were in the area, people who didn't themselves turn to Reformed doctrines. But it was one of the steps that in Providence God used to bring a number of people in Scotland to question the Roman Catholic system and to look critically and to evaluate the Reformed doctrines, and then found that they themselves actually agreed with the Reformed doctrines because they were scripturally based. They were based on Scripture. So Alesius, after his 4 weeks of disputation, had signally failed to recover Patrick Hamilton. Patrick Hamilton was martyred, and Alesius, or Alain, was himself questioning the position of the Roman Catholic Church and inclining towards the Reformed position.
And as you mentioned, this martyrdom had a profound effect upon him, it appears. And he wouldn't condemn it, as did many of the other clerics. They wouldn't condemn it. And he also then begins preaching for piety and for devotion. And that gets him in a lot of trouble, doesn't it?
He was beginning to come under suspicion because he was, if not supportive, certainly he didn't. He had stopped arguing against the reformers, and that brought him under immediate suspicion. That meant that people were watching out for what his actual views were, and it became clear that when the other ecclesiastics, the other canons of St. Andrews, were discussing the opinions and martyrdom of Patrick Hamilton, that they were beginning to see that the system they had followed in the Roman Catholic Church was not what Scripture taught. So he refused to condemn Patrick Hamilton. He refused to condemn Hamilton's opinions, and he also could not approve of the execution that had taken place. So he, in a sense, his silence became offensive. It became offensive particularly to the prior, the ecclesiastical superior of Alexandra Lane. This was a man known whose name was Patrick Hepburn, and Hepburn was a really coarse and worldly man who was known to have many mistresses, and he'd certainly in excess of 13 illegitimate children to his various mistresses. And he was notorious for his openly immoral life. So once Patrick Hepburn heard Elaine preaching, he began to feel that some of the preaching was directed specifically against his own immorality. Now, Elaine was addressing them in Latin, and he exhorted the people in authority over the church to be pious, to be moral, to study Christian doctrine, and to teach and to govern the people in a scriptural way. And he himself said that he spoke earnestly against immorality, but that he had not mentioned anybody by name. He had not given any offense to good men, but he had just attacked immorality. Of course, this was like a red rag to a bull as far as the prior was concerned. He was absolutely convinced that Elaine was preaching against him and holding him up to ridicule. So the result was that Elaine was imprisoned, and he was seized by Hepburn. Hepburn actually wanted to dispatch him on the spot without imprisoning him. He just wanted to run him through with his sword, but he was kept back from that. But he was taken off to prison. So Elaine went into prison, and when we're talking about prison, we're not talking about an easy existence. We're talking really about very, very primitive conditions with no sanitation, a filthy dungeon where he was surrounded by toads and it would seem some form of snakes. Now, there's only a couple of snakes in Scotland. It may have been a slow worm, but certainly his surroundings were pretty atrocious. And this was really as punishment for his faithful preaching against immorality.
And it seems that while the prior was against him, many of the other clerics were very much on his side, because don't they petition for his release and really fight to get him set free?
They eventually compelled the prior to bring Elaine out from the prison, and the prior Hepburn told Elaine that he was not to speak about the conditions, but notwithstanding, Elaine told the magistrates the truth, to the great annoyance of the prior, and he was put back in prison again. And his imprisonment, however, was slightly different. It was no longer in the dungeon. It was within the confines of the priory. And whenever the prior was away, the other canons would allow Elaine out and had him preach to them. So that was certainly indicated that they were very favorable towards him, they were very sympathetic towards his position. So they would take him out of confinement and allow him to participate in the services. And unfortunately, on one occasion, in December 1531, Hepburn returned to St. Andrews a bit unexpectedly and found Elaine in the middle of officiating in a service. So he made sure that Elaine was back in confinement, and he told him that he would be returned to the dungeon. However, the other canons believed that that was just the first stage towards execution, so they very hurriedly hatched up a plot to spring Elaine from the prison so that he could make good his escape.
And that's exactly what they did, did they? It's just a kind of a swashbuckling thing, but he goes down to Dundee and escapes. But that gets some of the other canons in real trouble, doesn't it?
They came up with this plan to get him out of prison that very night. And so under the cover of darkness, he made his way northwards to the shore of the Firth of Tay, quite a few miles. And by the morning, he had crossed the estuary of the Tay and boarded a ship in Dundee and actually started his voyage across the North Sea. So by the time the alarm was raised that he was no longer where the prior expected him to be, he was actually on board a ship and heading across the North Sea, ostensibly towards Dieppe in northern France, which was a major trading port for Dundee. But circumstances changed. A big storm blew up, and he got blown across the North Sea and landed up in Sweden.
And as you talk about, he lands in Sweden, modern-day Malmö, and there's some Scottish refugees there with Reformation tendencies and beliefs there, and he works with them for many months. Can you tell us about that and the impact that may have had on his life?
As of course, in those days, trading nations had their traders based overseas, so there were people from Scotland in Malmö, just as they were in many other towns, and they had their own chaplain. And the chaplain they had in Malmö was a man called John Gow, who had written a book called The Right Way to Heaven, The Right Way to Heaven, a very Lutheran book. It was the first book which had been written to explain Lutheran doctrine to the people of Scotland. And John Gow had gone into exile, and so in Providence, Elaine got blown across the North Sea. He was very sick, of course, and he was only too glad to reach dry land. The ship was so badly damaged that it was going to take months and months to repair, so he very happily fitted into the Scots community in Malmö and heard John Gow preaching to them. So it was in Providence a very remarkable set of events, and it confirmed him in his faith, and also he was able to preach to the Scottish people there. So he found the people there very kind to him, and he, even many years later, 25 years later, he was still writing about the kindness of these Scottish Lutherans in Malmö who had looked after him during those many months. And of course, he had to remain there until the ship got repaired. His intention was to get much further south, and it was easier just to wait for the ship to be repaired, even though that took many months.
So the ship gets repaired. It sets back on its way. So how does Alesius end up in Wittenberg then?
Okay, he reached Dieppe, and he made his way on foot northwards from Dieppe to Flanders. And when he was, some details of his journey are known. He'd gone to Bruges, possibly also to Antwerp, and then he went eastwards into Germany and reached Cologne, where he was very favorably received by the Archbishop of Cologne, a man by the name of Hermann von Wied. And von Wied afterwards became a friend of the Reformation, although at that particular time he was thoroughly Roman Catholic. He hadn't decided to break with the Roman Catholic Church. But during the time that Alain was in Cologne, he saw the martyrdom of two Lutheran men. They were burned at the stake for their opinions. And this confirmed him even more of his need to side with the reformers. And he went eastwards across Germany until he arrived in Wittenberg and enrolled as a student there in October 1532. In order to enroll as a student, he had to sign the Augsburg Confession, which he did most willingly. And yes, he spent his time in Wittenberg, and when he graduated, as far as I've been able to make out, he was the first Scottish graduate from the University of Wittenberg.
Dr. Robert Dickey, thank you so much for this very, very interesting life account of Alexander Alesius. And thank you for getting us to Wittenberg. And we'd like to invite you and our listeners back next week as we carry on our conversation to see what happens next with Alesius. Thank you again for being with us, and we invite everybody to join us next week.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.